Hello, everybody. Welcome to this wonderful, wonderful opera theatre. My name is Peter Suskind, and if you have been coming to these talks any time in the last 15 years or so, you will have seen me before. So I always like to start with a very brief mention about this fantastic building. We are so lucky. I consider this to be the second opera company, opera house in the country. Of course, the Met takes some beating. And if you happen to come from Chicago or Houston, take it from me. I'm a long time resident of this fair city, and this is actually the best. So, I don't know how many of you have ever seen this opera before. It's very, very, oh good, thank you, very rarely performed, and so I have a lot to talk about. That's why I started very, very promptly on the second, because I'm going to try and squeeze in as much as I can. It's a huge challenge to mount this opera because a number of reasons. First of all, it takes five top-class solo singers and a bunch of very, very good secondary singers, and on top, as well as that, it has possibly the largest orchestra of almost any opera ever. And if you can see into the pit, you'll see once they come in that they're like they're like sardines. I mean, there's so many of them in there. It's a huge, huge orchestra. And on top of that, there are many, many scene changes, and that makes it difficult and expensive. And so those are some of the reasons that it's not done so much. So aren't we lucky that we've actually got it here and that we have a top-class, first-rate opera company that can put it on? So, since it is rarely performed, I'm going to weave my remarks around the story because I think even the most ardent opera aficionados among you here, and by the way, thank you all, so many of you, for coming. It's wonderful to see such a big crowd here. However many of you are big opera fans, not many of you are going to know this story. And to be honest, even if you do, it can do with some reminding. It is a very, very complicated story. So, tiny bit of background. The creation of the work was kind of difficult, even though Strauss was working with his favorite librettist, Hofmannsthal. he started it in 1911, but the first performance didn't come till 1919. Remember those dates, because there's going to be a test at the end. It's a sort of magic fairy tale, drawing on various sources, including Goethe, the Arabian Nights, Grimm's fairy tales. And by the way, remember the word magic, because that's going to come into the test at the end too. As I am a big Wagner fanatic, I find this kind of inspiration fascinating. But while Wagner used Nordic myths, this actually takes its story from more southerly and more easterly ideas. In fact, a book called The Myths of the Occident and the Orient, I tracked down, is one of the things that Hofmannsthal saw. So problems arose because the librettist wanted to emphasize all of the heavy symbolism that comes in those stories. And of course, Strauss, being an opera composer, wanted the opera to appeal to you, the audience, and to be entertaining and, of course, somewhat educational, but not so heavy that you didn't understand what was going on. How successful that is going to be, you're going to know about it by the end of this afternoon. He was already a very well-established opera composer, Strauss. He had written Salome, then Elektra, and to this day taken, by the way, as a role model in large and elaborate orchestration. It's taught in orchestration classes, Elektra. And then, of course, Rosenkavalier came next, his supreme masterpiece, which many of you will know, I think. Just as a funny little side note here, nearly all of his operas have female protagonists, main and title characters. Just for the record, the ones that came after this were Daphne, Arabella, and the Egyptian Helen. So he had a thing about the female voice, something, by the way, he shared with his favorite composer, Mozart. That's also going to be part of the test at the end. So, Salome, Elektra, and Rosenkavalier, where would he go next? Well, before Die Frau came Ariadne, a somewhat curious hybrid of an opera, opera and a play. And I'm not going to linger on that because we have to get on to Die Frau. It took a long time, but he used a lot of the elements of those four previous operas in terms of style. Salome, he used, for instance, there's some mysterious and dark music that comes in Salome. In Elektra, there's some very dramatic and violent music in Elektra. And then in Rosenkavalier, there's a lot, but what you remember is all of those lush, wonderful, wonderful melodies and those wonderful waltzes and a very beautiful, beautiful, lush sound. You get all of this in this opera, mixed together very, very successfully. He had become, or was becoming, a very mature and expert opera composer, and so he used a lot of all of those, and you're going to hear all of that in this particular opera. So, let's get going with the story. I'm looking at my watch because there's so much to tell you about here. There's a brief backstory, and which in very Wagnerian fashion we get told in the first act. The emperor has been hunting, and he captures a beautiful gazelle with the help of his red falcon. Symbols are going to be so many that I'm not going to be able to... But just remember, all of these things, they're all symbolic in one way or another. You're going to hear the music of the falcon all the way through, and if you know what a raptor, a hawk, any of those hawks sound like when they're flying and they squawk in the air, it's a strange sort of squeak, rough kind of sound. You hear it early on here and all through. So that is obviously one of the leitmotifs, but I'm not going to talk about leitmotifs because we have to get back to the story. So as it happens, the gazelle is a supernatural creature, the daughter of Kekabad, king of the spirits, who is like a sort of southern Votan for you Wagner fans, but she can be transformed into a beautiful woman and is, and as you know, supernatural beings can do all sorts of clever things. Naturally, the emperor falls desperately in love with her, this gorgeous creature, the minute he sees her. And at some point, and we learn that he has married her, but we're also told that they made passionate love in the first hour after their meeting. This was in the days before our beloved Puritans, by the way. However, she has, that's something that as a Brit, I feel deeply ashamed about and sorry that we brought those people to you, but never mind. She has one terrible flaw. She has no shadow. So now maybe you're getting an idea about the title of this opera. She cannot have children, and that is one of the qualities that goes with not having a shadow, infertility. And all of this is before the opera has even begun. So now the opera starts with a messenger who has been coming for the last 11 months telling the nurse who has been attending the empress that time is up. In 3 days, unless she gains a shadow somehow, her beloved emperor will be turned to stone. That's what you get for marrying a supernatural being, who is the daughter of a king of the gods, no less. Conversely, it's also the punishment for the fairy princess, so to speak, for falling in love with a mortal. So shades again of Brunhilde and Wagner and all kinds of stuff. The emperor appears, preparing to go hunting in the hope that he can recapture the falcon who started this whole story off. Then we see the nurse, who herself has great supernatural powers and is a major player in this drama. She wears black clothes in this production, so you can't miss the fact that she's a baddie, right? The empress also appears and bemoans that she cannot have children and asks her nurse what can be done. As all good witchy nurses do, she suggests a solution, which is to go down from the lofty heights of the royal Valhalla-like palace to the grubby, depressing real world below. Again, shades of the ring from Wagner. Consequently, scene two finds us in the humble home of Barak the Dyer and his wife. They are not a happy couple, and by an interesting coincidence, they too are childless. Barak sadly sings of his wish to have the happy sound of children in his humble abode. Gib mir du Kinder, and could we have example one, please? To deliver his wares, and hey presto, the empress and the nurse magically appear, ready to try to persuade his wife to part with her precious shadow. They offer all sorts of riches, and she agrees to sleep separately from her husband for 3 nights, by the way, the same 3 nights before the emperor will be turned to stone by happy coincidence. There are two fascinating choruses in this scene. I bet this is the first time that you have heard a chorus of unborn children. So that's what we have here, and very significant it is too. They're bewailing the fact that they are, yes, you've got it, unborn. Then just before the end, we hear the night watchman. Again, Wagner fans will recall the night watchman at the end of Meistersinger. except this is a chorus, and they are praising the joys of marital love. In a way, this is one of the most serious moments in the opera. It's such irony. Barak has just been banished from his wife's bed, and both these choruses, by the way, act very much in the fashion of Greek choruses in Greek dramas, commenting on the action and at this point explaining really the whole theme of the opera, which we're going to come to. Okay, second act. The empress and nurse work on Barak's wife, who, by the way, is never given a name, so you might conclude that she represents an archetype of some sort. remember that they're trying to steal her shadow so the empress can become fertile, and also to prevent her beloved husband, the emperor, from being turned into stone. I know, it's such a strange story, isn't it? And has to be seen as brimming over, literally, with symbolism. And we'll come to some of that later. They try to entice her with a handsome man, since she has already admitted that her heart is empty. The nurse has magic power, so it's a piece of cake for her to conjure up a handsome guy. Barak's wife is interested, but before this idea can develop, Barak comes back from a very successful day at the market, and he brings his three rowdy brothers, whom we met earlier in the act, and a bunch of hungry children. So he's happy, of course, to have children all around him. She is not, mainly because she's an unhappy and bitter woman at this point in the opera. So on to the next scene, two. And this, by the way, is where we can begin to see the frequent scene changes I mentioned at the beginning. I have mentioned that these scene changes require time, of course, and so there are a number of very beautiful, purely orchestral interludes. In fact, some of the most beautiful music in the whole opera comes in these interludes. In this particular production, you'll see that many of the scene changes actually happen before your very eyes, which is great. It's a wonderful production, by the way. Let me just remind you that this production is the work of the famous artist David Hockney, and consequently it is stunningly beautiful and unusual, too, to see. So that's something to look forward to. Here is a short excerpt from Orchestral Interlude Number 1. This one is more dramatic than tender, but still very Straussian. It represents Kekabad, the majestic and powerful king of the gods. Example 2, please. had to cut it here. Thank you so much. I'm sorry, I would love to play more of you, but you can see how dramatic that is. I just had more story to tell you. back to the hunting lodge in the forest, and the emperor who has been led to this, the falconer's lodge, by the trusty falcon. He sees the empress and nurse surreptitiously going in and is suspicious. His anger flares up, and in another Wagnerian moment, draws a sword. We all remember that. Think about Notung. But he relents because, of course, he loves her. In the words of one of the synopses I read, I had to do a lot of research on this one, I can tell you. He resolves to seek out some isolated ravine to be alone with his misery. So, unhappy emperor. Now we return back to the Barak's home, where Barak is given a sleeping potion. So, here again, sleeping potion, singing birds, dramatic swords. Those of you who know Wagner will recognize all of those things. Barak's wife, I missed a paragraph here. All this is, Barak is drugged by the nurse, because she wants to try and persuade the wife to, what's the nice way of putting this, have relations with this handsome young man whom she has conjured up. However, the empress is getting more and more uneasy about all of this. She can see that the deception of stealing Barak's wife's shadow and making Barak very unhappy is not a good thing, and she is becoming slowly less of a fairy supernatural being and more of a human being, which is one of the themes of the whole opera. Keep that thought in mind as well. So now we have another beautiful interlude before we return to the hunting lodge, where we find the empress sleeping very uneasily. She's more and more convinced that what she and the nurse are doing is cruel and is hurting Barak way too much. The orchestra tells us that the falcon is about to reappear, because you can hear that squawking sound as the motif for the bird. Then we go back to Barak's pad again. See what I mean about numerous scene changes. And this is the climactic scene where Barak's wife renounces her ability to have children. She's already pretty grumpy at this point, and she doesn't really want to have children, and he does. And the fact that she now renounces it altogether is something of a triumph for the wicked nurse. And it's, again, a bit like Alberich in the Ring renouncing love so that he can get the gold. You remember that. And she admits that she has sold her soul to the devil, to the nurse in this case, to give away her shadow. So at this point, the wicked nurse seems to have succeeded. You may remember that I mentioned Goethe as one of the influences. Well, Goethe's Faust sells his soul to the devil, just as Hoffmann does in The Tales of Hoffmann, just as Tom Rakewell does in The Rake's Progress, and so on. So it is a theme that is known in literature and opera. Barak's wife then, sort of surprisingly, confesses that she has slept with the handsome apparition. All hell is let loose. In the middle of which, the empress finally realizes that she does not want to be part of the bloodbath which seems about to ensue, and is totally repentant about what they've been trying to do. So as Barak prepares to kill his wife, because he's so furious with her, she admits that she spoke falsely. She hadn't actually slept with the guy. And the whole act ends in high drama and very, very loud as it happens. And the words that come to us are, a higher power is at work here, we are told. Act three. This starts with a sort of duet between Barak and his wife, very Straussian and beautiful love music, even though they're in different places, both physically and spiritual. They stand on each side of the stage, so you'll see that. She realizes that she really does love him, and he is stricken with remorse that he could have thought of killing her. Next comes one of the great scenes in the whole opera, where the empress and the nurse are approaching the great temple door, and we see the characters of these two much more clearly. The nurse is, as ever, the sorceress, witch type, but the empress is gaining her humanity. She acknowledges her closeness to her father, Kierkegaard, the God figure, in a way that again reminds me of the complicated and profound relationship between Brunhilde and Wotan, her father. But she feels guilt at harming Barak and his wife. She finally manages to reject the nurse and all her wicked doings, and the nurse is banished, and the Empress enters the Holy of Holies to some of the most dramatic and violent music in the opera. Here is a moment of high drama when the Empress is asking herself, at what cost am I doing this? Is this fair to the poor dyer and his wife? Example three, please. Okay, thank you very much. You can hear that does sound like Strauss through and through, does it not? Some of the tenderest music in this opera comes in this section. She realizes that she has failed to gain the shadow needed to cure her infidelity, even though Barak's wife has by now lost hers. But at the same time, she has become more human and kinder. She summons her father, the all-powerful god Kierkegaard, only to find that her beloved husband, the emperor, has indeed been turned to stone. Because she was too kind and too human, and so failed to obtain a shadow. But amazingly, by the magical power of Kierkegaard, she finds that she has indeed not only gained the missing shadow, but equally amazingly, he emerges from the rock alive. You will hear our fabulous tenor sing one of his finest moments here as he rejoices as she looks on adoringly. The unborn children who have appeared at various points also rejoice at their release. She will be able to have children. So accompanied by triumphant music, the opera heads to its somewhat surprising ending, happy ending, but not before Barak and his wife are also released from their torments to find that her shadow is intact after all, and they are happily in love again and are also able to have children. The opera ends exactly in the manner of Strauss's favorite composer, Mozart, with the joyful ensemble of all four protagonists. So, we do have a little afterword from the Greek, from the chorus of Unborn Children. They have the very last words. So, I've only got a couple of minutes. So what is this all about? I'm sure you've been contemplating that too. The first question is, what is the significance of being without a shadow? Well, in mythology and symbolism, and this opera is certainly drenched in both, supernatural creatures, including, of course, ghosts, have no shadow. So it's associated with death. I'm going to skip a little bit here. On a more positive note, that the Egyptians believed the shadow to be another part of a person's soul. And that resonates with this story because the Empress is incomplete until she gains a shadow, not only infertile, but without true human feelings. So my last thought on this subject is another biblical reference, which I've actually skipped the first one. My greatest desire is that whenever my shadow falls behind me as I walk, may whatever it falls on be blessed. So there is a bit of a conflict between the mythical notion of the shadow belonging to dark forces and a renewal of humanity. Now we come to the test part of the talk. I said that Mozart was Strauss's favourite opera, and I've already mentioned Wagnerian moments, but there's also a fascinating comparison to Mozart's magic flute. If you think about it, you get a gold star if you remember the word magic, by the way. Mozart also gives us two contrasting couples searching for the path of wisdom and virtue. And after severely testing trials and ordeals, that opera also boasts an evil woman in the person of the Queen of the Night, by the way. So I'm going to skip because I do have actually more to tell you, but unfortunately 1:30 is coming up. And so if you don't understand everything that's going on, I'm with you, by the way. It is a very complicated story. What is that this or that piece of symbolism about? Just enjoy the glorious music, the magnificent singing, and the staging with all the glamour of the Hockney sets and costumes. And here are the two very final thoughts. The power of love. The joy and satisfaction of marital love and bearing of children is a wonderful blessing. And Cacobad uses his godlike power to reverse the curse which has been hanging over both couples because he loves his daughter. And lastly, remember that chorus of unborn children. There can be redemption through children, even unborn ones. Thank you very much.